It's 9:06. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Well, officials from the Arab League arrived in Syria yesterday as violence continues between government security forces and opposition activists. This morning, we're going to talk about the situation in Syria. We'll talk about the history of this situation and the possible future of the Syrian uprising. Joining me this morning, Joseph Ohmert, adjunct professor at American University's School of International Service in Washington, D.C. Good morning, and thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
My pleasure.
Let's start with, this uprising started 9 months ago, it seems, but Syria had a long history of instability prior to 1970, didn't it?
Yeah, sure. Syria used to be called, or rather nicknamed in a negative way, the sick man of the Middle East. You know, in the old days they used to call the Ottoman Empire the sick man on the Bosphorus. So it had a history of many coup d'etats and counter-coup d'etats and merger with Egypt in 1958. The union with Egypt, which was basically a result of the chronic instability and the inability of the political body in Syria to maintain itself, to sustain itself as a state. And then, of course, came the regime that is now in power in 1970, or basically they came to power in 1963. There were 7 years of infighting between various factions in the Baath regime, and then the Assad regime was finally instituted in November of 1970. So you can talk here about 41 years of so-called stability. But the stability was always achieved through the use of power and the frightening and the cowing of the people of Syria. Most of them, Sunni people, never accepted the legitimacy of the Baath regime for being secular and also being Alawite-dominated, Alawites being an offshoot of Shia Islam, not even Shiites. So most of the Sunnis never accepted their legitimacy. So it was stability through power and strength, not through political legitimacy.
So a majority of the people in the country have not thought that the government has been legitimate. I'm trying to get a handle on this. One of the things that I've been reading is that a lot of people who are in the military have been more or less defecting. They've refused to shoot civilians, and they've joined the activists. What I'm getting at is, if a majority of the people in the country didn't like what was going on, didn't think that the government was legitimate, how were they able to put together enough people in authority, positions of authority, to be able to maintain their control for this many years?
Okay, so that requires a little bit of an explanation about the fact, about the way the armed forces in Syria are being composed, so that you need to understand the background for this. It's somewhat complicated, I understand. You talk here about three elements of military, basically: the regular army, the special forces, and the intelligence and security apparatus. The special forces and the security and intelligence apparatus, these are the organs that basically try to put down the rebellion. Now, they are composed mainly of minorities, the Alawites and others, which constitute something like 25-30% of the population. You talk here about 7-8 million out of 22-23 million people in Syria. So there are enough people that could man those organs, those bodies. Now, the regular army, here is where the problem is. The defectors are mostly Sunni soldiers and junior Sunni officers. And even in the army, most of the high officers are either Alawites or other minorities. So this is exactly what happens. The regime is starting to collapse from within along sectarian lines. And the Sunni soldiers, the defectors, they basically do what they do because they want to defend their own people.
Is when Bashar al-Assad took over from his father, there was some hope that there would be some reforms, that there would be a relaxation of certain restrictions, that things would be a little better for the average Syrian person. What happened?
Well, there was an expectation that was also promoted or fostered by some people that happened to think that because Bashar was educated in England and he's a doctor, an ophthalmologist, you know, and he speaks good English, that in itself would make him more amenable and open-minded towards winds of change. But that has proved to be somewhat naive also in the case, by the way, of the Iranian Revolution. If you recall, in the early days after the revolution, the Ayatollahs were surrounded by professors from all over the world who came back to Iran, and of course they were all removed later on and the conservative elements took over. Now, Bashar may have wanted to make reforms, but he couldn't really because the elements around him of the old regime were too powerful, and they're still too powerful. And the reason for that is that they know, they understand that what really is in the basis of all that is that there is a sense of deep, profound mistrust of the regime by the majority people. And if you open even the economy, say, for liberalization, you can't confine liberalization in the economy only to business. You have to open it up to political change and all that, and that's something that they couldn't afford. So the regime was going one step forward, two steps backward, like in what they call Yemenite dance. You know, you go one step forward, you go two steps backwards, and vice versa. And Bashar may have wanted to institute reforms. He may have believed that he should do it, but he simply could not. There was a joke in Syria in the early days after he came to power, you know. The joke was that he was sitting in the same room as his father sat, you know, with the same people around him, whereas the old father used to blink in his eyes. The generals understood what he wanted. Now the generals blink in their eyes and Bashar understands what they want. So, you know, nothing really has changed in that sense. There were some personal changes, but people that were replacing other people were basically from the same mold. It wasn't really an opening towards the vast majority of Sunnis who really don't like the regime.
So is Bashar al-Assad not the person who's really in charge? Is he just a figurehead and the generals are running things?
I won't be surprised if behind the scenes that's what happens. You talk here about a group of generals, among them his own brother Bayer Assad, who is his junior brother, a younger brother, who is the commander of the 4th Division of the army, which is basically the division that cracks down on the rebellion. Now, the reason that they use this 4th Division is because it's Alawite, led by his brother, and they can't trust the regular army, so they send this division from one place to another. That's why it takes them more time to do what otherwise they would have done in a quicker way. And then, of course, there is the brother-in-law, General Shaukat, who is the deputy chief of staff. He's married to their sister, Bushra. There were rumors that he was killed a few days ago in a feud with one other general. You know, this is a very bizarre tribalistic regime. And I can give you more names of people like that, but 90% of them, if not even more, are Alawites. And they understand that if they are down, that will be a bloodbath, you know, a revenge will be taken against them, and they are fighting for their lives.
So there have been other attempts or other smaller uprisings in Syria before the current one, which began with the so-called Arab Spring 9 months ago. What's different this time?
Well, the main difference is that when you call attention to the previous big rebellion, which was in the 70s, it was more like a campaign of terrorism on the part of the Muslim Brotherhood against the regime, which had distinct Sunni-Muslim character against the Alawite regime, and they did not manage to mobilize the general population, so they resorted to terrorism. And in the end of the day, they were crushed by the regime in the city of Hama in February, March of 1982, when about 10,000-15,000, maybe more people were killed by the Assad regime. At that time, the commander of the operation was the brother of Hafez Assad, Rifat Assad, who is now in exile. So you see again the family tribalistic connection here. The difference is that this time the uprising is much more popular in nature. That is to say, it's a real expression of the frustration of the masses, and the Muslim Brotherhood are not the only force behind it. They are one of the major forces, and if elections were to be held in Syria and they are free, clearly they would have a lot of the votes there. But it is not just the Muslim Brotherhood. It is basically an uprising that comprising the large majority of the Sunni population. And the slogans used by the in the uprising are not just about the Alawite nature of the regime. It's also about the economic and socio-economic situation in Syria. Don't forget that over 50% of the population in Syria live on less than $2 a day.
Hmm. That's amazing. And the Ba'ath Party is nominally socialist. Is that is the Syrian economy a socialist economy?
Well, nominally, the Ba'ath Party is a socialist party, and it intended to be a really socialist party, at least in the early 60s, when they really were engaged in all kinds of socialist experiments in the spirit of the day. At that time, influenced by the Cuban Revolution, by the Algerian Revolution, and so on, by the Vietnam War. But the fact of the matter is that it has become, like in such other systems in other parts of the world, it has become state bureaucracy absolutely imbued with corruption. If you want an explanation to this or illustration of that, the fact of the matter is that the cousin of the president, Rami Mahlouf, is a maternal cousin of his from the side of the mother. He is the richest person in Syria. What a coincidence. So a few months ago, he said on official Syrian television that he would donate back to charity $1 billion of his own money. So, of course, people said, why would you have $1 billion? How could you have $1 billion? And why won't you donate much more than that? So it just shows to you what it really deteriorated to. The Ba'ath regime basically cultivated the interest of the elements or the constituent group that supported it in the periphery and in the main cities. And the outlying areas became very impoverished, very poor. And therefore, don't be surprised that the rebellion started in the outlying areas, in the south, in Deraa, in the north, in Idlib, in the south, in the northeast, and so on. There is a water problem, among other problems, starvation that forced maybe 2 million peasants in the last few years from the outlying areas to the big cities. A terrible economic situation, and charges of corruption and state-run bureaucracy have been so rampant that even the regime on occasions had to admit it, and there was showcasing of trials against corrupt people and all that, but it never came to those on top that really benefited from all that, because these are the people around Bashar and his own family.
We don't hear much as much about Syria as we did about Libya, and I want to talk about what those differences are. But first, I want to give the phone number and the other means that people can use to contact us so we can widen this discussion. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number that you can use to get in touch this morning if you would like to make a comment or ask a question of our guest about what's going on in Syria. And we haven't even gotten to what's likely to happen. That we'll save a little bit for the second half of the program, but we're going to talk about that. We're trying to get some context for this. I don't think a lot of us have a lot of very much knowledge of what's really going on over there, and there are perhaps some good and some bad reasons for that. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, that's a toll-free number. The other ways to get in touch include email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave a comment there. We're talking about Syria with Joseph Olmert, adjunct professor at American University's School of International Service in Washington, D.C., and we'll be back in just a moment. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Almost 21 minutes after 9 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up later on today on the Ideas Network At Issue with Ben Marins. The Iowa caucus is now just 1 week away, and the first primary in New Hampshire is a week after that. But is one a better indication of the nation's political climate than the other? And just what is the difference between a caucus and a primary? After four, Ben and his guests discuss the history and politics of the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary. That's coming up later on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about Syria. Officials from the Arab League arrived in Syria yesterday. Violence continues between government security forces and opposition activists. We're discussing the history we're talking about how we got to this point and perhaps the possible future of the Syrian uprising. My guest is Joseph Olmert, adjunct professor at American University's School of International Service in Washington, D.C. Again, the number to call if you'd like to join the discussion, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, and there is a Kathleen Dunn Facebook, Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page that you can go and leave a comment on, and we will pass it along to the audience. And when I say we, I mean the producers put it on my screen and I read it. It's not, I'm not indicating any kind of royal we, just so we're clear on that. All right. The American press has not exactly jumped all over this story. And in fact, if you go out and search for news about the Syrian uprising, the most common sources for information are the BBC and Reuters. I wonder, Professor Olmert, if you have any idea why this isn't, why we're not paying as much attention to this story, as opposed to the situation in Libya, which captured everyone's attention almost immediately and was front page news during the whole of that crisis. What's the difference between how we're looking at the situation in Syria and how we looked at Libya?
Well, as a matter of fact, I give a course more or less on that particular issue, which is called the Foreign Policy in the News Media, and I'm not surprised by that. There is one big reason, and there are some other reasons. The big reason is, let's face it, I mean, American press is not so good on foreign policy coverage, period. There are many historical reasons for that, you know, and if we need to go into all that in depth, you know, it will take us more than a program. So we leave it like that. And that can be proved, of course. And this is also the source of criticism that you hear about American press from writers that write about it. What was the American press role in the days before, say, the invasion to Iraq in 2003? Was there a scrutiny of the situation? It was serious, reliable. The American public was presented with enough information to know what was going on. And so what was the case in, say, even Desert Storm in 1991, and so on and so forth. But come back to Libya and Syria. First of all, Gaddafi's personality has always been so colorful, you know, as opposed to Bashar, who was isolated, and not too many people even know that his name was Bashar. They knew that there is some kind of dictator in Damascus, but Gaddafi, you know, was at the forefront of the news, his appearance at the UN, if you recall, 2 years ago, and so on and so forth. But also the fact that there was a NATO involvement in Libya from the beginning, as opposed to the to Lechterov in Syria. So, you know, that in itself created a lot of interest, because it was us, NATO, and then America as part of it, even though the administration said it was from behind. And I can give you many more reasons, but the fact of the matter is, yes, you are absolutely right. We don't really know exactly what is happening. And if I have to gather my information, I take it from mostly from Syrian opposition sites, you know, in Arabic. And I must be honest with you, not all of them are very reliable. They tend to exaggerate. They tend to play up a situation. They tend to overplay sometimes descriptions of the situation and so on. So you need to be very careful in terms of what is really happening by trying to use, you know, what we know from the past and logic and so on. But, yeah, you are absolutely right. There is a difference of coverage here.
Some have suggested that there's more oil in Libya, and that's why we were paying attention to Libya.
Well, yeah, but look, I mean, America didn't need Libyan oil. I mean, I don't think that they, I don't know if even 1% of your consumption came from Libya. It was more like the Europeans. But, yeah, of course, always oil is in the forefront of that. But I don't think that this was the main thing to be fair about that. You know, I mean, you know what? If Gaddafi did not appear in the UN, say, 2 years ago, you would not have the same image of it. But you remember the visit, the bizarre speech, all the build-up toward the visit and all that, which caused a lot of attention to Gaddafi and so on, and also the stories about his family and so on and so forth, you know. And you know what, compare it with Ahmadinejad in Iran. I mean, had he not showed up in the UN, year in, year out, you know, very few people may know that this is the guy and whatever happened. But since he appears every year, he went to Colombia, he called attention to himself. Bashar Assad never visited the U.S., you know, you'll be surprised to hear that. His father did not visit the U.S. Whenever he met with American presidents, he made the point of meeting them on neutral ground. So he met people in Europe. Or Clinton came to Damascus, but he never set foot in America.
What has the relationship been between the United States and Syria? Syria was an ally of the Soviet Union during at least the later portion of the Cold War. They still have a relationship with Russia. What has been the U.S. relationship with Syria?
It's been a rocky relationship, as you can imagine, because the Syrians were allies of the Soviet Union, but also because of the support of terrorism that put them on the list of states supporting terrorism, the list of the State Department, and the situation in Lebanon. Remember that the Syrians were in occupation of large parts of Lebanon until 2005 in the Cedar Revolution, when they were pushed out. And the American administration did not like it. They did not like the fact that Syria was in support of Hezbollah, support of Hamas in Gaza. Until recently, the leadership of Hamas was based in Damascus. And so many other reasons. So a very bad relationship. But the new administration tried to change all that, you know, as part of their overall strategy of trying to reach out to rogue regimes like Iran even, or even North Korea. So there was a dialogue with Syria, and an American ambassador was sent to Syria, but he was recalled back and then sent again because of what happened there. So you can argue that the administration tried to do something, but it wasn't really helpful, because the struggle in Syria, we need to understand it. Look, this is a struggle for life or death between the majority Sunni population and the Alawite-dominated regime. And there is very little that America or any other country from the outside could do to change it.
That's a great point, because it goes back to NATO intervened in Libya, and the premise was it was humanitarian, that they were trying to avert a large loss of life, and that it looked like the Libyan army was going to start slaughtering civilians. Well, by the UN's count, 5,000 have died in Syria in the last 9 months, and who knows how accurate that number is. It could be bigger, it could be smaller. Information, accurate information, seems to be a little scarce, as you have pointed out. It's tough to really know what's going on. But if we take the 5,000 figure that the UN is using, that's a lot of human lives lost, and who knows how many before this 9-month uprising took place? Who knows how many will die in the future? And again, there has to be some reason other than the fact that that Colonel Gaddafi called attention to himself why NATO decided to intervene in Libya, but refused and vocally refused to do anything about what some are calling the slaughter of innocent civilians in Syria.
Well, there are other reasons, and one of them is, of course, that they did not expect any meaningful opposition from the Libyan army in Libya, because the Libyan army has never been a real army. It was more or less like a force to oppress its own people, whereas the Syrian army could put up at least some of elements of it, could put up resistance to NATO, and that could create a crisis that will go beyond the borders of Syria, or at least will not be so easy to contain. But that may be another reason here, and I think that the American administration doesn't want to be involved in another conflict in the world that will make it like the fourth or fifth foreign intervention. And the Syrian opposition itself, at least until recently, did not call for foreign intervention. They refused categorically to have it in all their announcements, including the famous meeting that they took, held in Antalya in Turkey in late May, early June of this year. They specifically said they would not like to see foreign intervention.
So the Arab League has sent in its monitors. Let's talk about how the other countries in that region look at Syria. How is Syria viewed in Saudi Arabia, for example, or Iraq, for that matter, Kuwait, Egypt? How is the Syrian government looked at by its neighbors?
Well, if you ask about that, clearly, I mean, most of the Arab world, which is Sunni dominated, would not like to see this regime surviving. And if at all there was any sense of kind of glossing over the situation in Syria for all those years or looking behind the shoulders on the part of the Arabs, it was because this regime maintained that there was some stability in Syria. So, you know, I mean, that's the devil, you know. You don't want to turn it upside down. You never know what will come instead of it. But now that this claim for stability was finally shattered irreversibly, the Arab states clearly showed their true colors. I mean, what they really think about this regime. And the Saudis, for example, have recalled their ambassador from Damascus. They definitely support the rebels in various ways. The Egyptians are very unhappy about what is happening. Just yesterday I read a statement from one of the Egyptian inspectors, a guy by the name of Bajoub, who said that what the Syrians are doing, after being in Syria already, after being there for a few days, it's no less than ethnic cleansing, genocide, and whatever. And the same applies to Kuwait, Jordan, of course, the Sunni population in Lebanon. Former Prime Minister Hariri in public is calling for the downfall of the Syrian regime, it's for obvious reasons. They were behind the murder of his father. And then we come to Iraq. And it is a problem that the former Bush administration, you know, and the current Obama administration will have to give their opinion on. The fact of the matter is that the Shia government of Iraq is trying to help Syria. And at the same time that America, which is an ally of Iraq and that has invested so much in blood and resources in the war in Iraq, is so much against the Syrian regime, the Iraqi government is in favor of the Syrian regime. Just imagine what could it be if also the Iraqis were opposed to the Syrians, so the entire borders of Syria would be like close to the regime. But the fact of the matter is it's not the case. And that, by the way, calls attention to the sectarian element of all that. Iraqi government is Shi'i, Iran is Shi'i, and the Alawites are an offshoot of Shia Islam, and the rest of the Arab world are Sunni states. So here is, if you want, the bottom line of all that.
What about Turkey?
That's a great question. You know, in one of my articles, I described an interesting episode from the Second World War. And pardon me for giving some history, but we need to have background to all that. You know, when 1941, the state of the Allies in the Middle East seemed to be so bad, the Nazis were all over the place, and the British decided to invade Syria and Lebanon to save it from falling to the Nazis because there was a Vichy government there, you know. So they approached the Turks and asked them, could you help us? So we'll give you northern part of Syria, and we should take the southern part. The Turks said, oh, no, you know, we don't want to interfere with these people. We control them for 400 years, and they are not nice people, you know. Now, of course, things have changed because Prime Minister Erdogan and the AKP party in Ankara are having a much higher profile of Islamic position about the Middle East. That's one of the reasons for the rift with Israel. There are others. And so they have started to they were the first to speak against the Syrian regime from the beginning of the uprising, calling upon the regime to stop whatever happens. Among other reasons, they don't want it to become a chaotic situation because of the fact that there are 2 million Kurds inside Syria on the border between Syria, Turkey, and Iraq. And as you know, there are troubles inside Turkey with the Kurds. So you see how complicated all this is. You know, what happens in one country affects another country or other countries. The Turks are very, very upset about the situation in Syria. They are helping the rebels, including the military wing of the rebels, I mean the Army of Free Syria. They train them. They supply them with arms. There's no question about that. And they threaten to create a buffer zone on the border between Syria and Turkey in order to allow the opposition to be based there and so on. But that remains to be seen exactly when and how they will do it. I guess, and there are rumors about that in recent weeks something has slowed down in Syria because of the illness of Prime Minister Erdogan that may affect the direction of the Turkish policy because he is the strongman, basically, and he is the one who makes all the decisions. I'm not sure that I understand exactly if that's the case or not, but I've noticed in the last few days that the Turks have slowed down a little bit. They've lowered the tone about Syria. They may be more preoccupied with their own issues.
We're starting to get some phone calls. Still room for you if you'd like to call right now. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Let's go to the phones and take a call from Pat in Richland first. Pat, good morning.
Happy holidays, gentlemen. Hey, you know, the question that you've been asking since the show began about why is Washington so hands-off in the Syrian uprising, and I think it's a great question, too, and I think it's very important, that question, because through your guests there, you may not understand that us in America, we have been hearing the rhetoric for decades now about how Syria is so bad, and such a bad influence, and boy, they should, you know, they got to go, the regime. And now when there's a chance to, you know, do something to topple a regime, there isn't even any encouragement from Washington to the uprising at all. So it's pretty obvious to us that, you know, Washington and Syria, Washington isn't the big enemy of Syria as we thought. I guess the question is, how long has it been like that? And this is just the sort of thing that makes us people skeptical out here about Washington.
Well, you know, I don't want to get into a discussion about Washington in that sense, but no, I disagree with our caller, with Pat, to an extent, because I don't think that it's true that the administration does not help the Syrian rebels. They do help them in various ways. Some of them are less subtle, some of them are more subtle, some of them are covert, and you know. But there definitely is American support, and you should know that, you know, when the ambassador was sent back, Robert Ford, about 2 years ago, there was a lot of criticism. Why would they send back the ambassador to Damascus? Syria did not change. It's not a nice country, which I agree with. And the criticism came mainly from conservative right-wing or neocons and so on. And now I think that everybody understands that the fact that there is an American embassy in Damascus means that the Syrian opposition can be in touch with them. They could be in touch with the opposition. It's very helpful to the opposition. And by the way, that's what I hear from Syrian activists, and I have connections with some of them. So, based in the U.S., of course. But, yeah, I agree with you that overall, one might have expected to have a much more forceful or a forceful military intervention. I think that the American administration simply doesn't want to get involved in another military conflict, period. Now, you as an American can assess why. I mean, I can understand the reasons. The fact of the matter is that, yes, there is a distinct gap or difference between the rhetoric used against Syria in the past and what is being done right now. But make no mistake, I think that the Bashar Assad regime knows that this administration wants to see its downfall. The Syrian opposition knows that the American administration is on their side, and all kinds of things are happening, not always are open to the public, that indicate to me at least that the administration is doing more than what catches the eye.
Pat, thanks for the call. We're talking about the situation in Syria, and my guest is Joseph Omert, adjunct professor at American University's School of International Service in Washington, D.C. He is on the phone with me. You can be, too, at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Also, you can check out the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave a comment there as well. When we come back, one of the things I want to get into here a little bit is what comes next. Is it possible that there could just be a general civil war in Syria? And what about the possibility of this conflict spilling over into the rest of the Middle East? And we've got some calls that we need to get in as well. So, lots to do in the last 20 minutes of the program. We'll get right to it in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:41. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stick around. After the news at 10 o'clock, how has the era of big data affected science and knowledge? Next hour, my guest and I will talk about how digital information is flooding our planet and helping us understand it better. That's coming up in the next hour here on the Kathleen Dunn Program. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. My guest this hour, Joseph Omert, adjunct professor at American University's School of International Service in Washington, D.C. And let's go back to the phones and take a call from Diane in Milwaukee. Diane, good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to know, what are the differences between the Sunni and the Shia that cause them in Syria and Iraq to kill each other. I thought they were all Muslims, and I don't understand.
Well, it's a great question. The difference is basically, it began, if you will, as a political difference. It developed into some kind of a religious difference, not so significant in theory, but much more so in practice. The difference was about the succession of the prophet. When the prophet died, who should succeed him? And there was a big debate about the succession following the third and the fourth successors of the prophet. Who should it be? The Shiites are those who believe that Ali, who was a cousin of the prophet, his descendant should have been in control, and the Sunnis are those who believe that it wasn't to be the case. So that created the beginning of the rift, and then, of course, it developed into some kind of a more religious imbued conflict, because the Shiites added another pillar to the five basic pillars of Islam, and this pillar is the devotion to the house of Ali. But the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of the Arabs and the Muslims altogether are Sunnis. The only country in the Middle East, basically in the Islamic world, which is 90%, maybe less, but almost 90%, Shi'i is Iran. And that is interesting because there are various theories about it. Why did the Iranians become the Shi'i country of the Middle East? And one of the explanations, I emphasize just one of them, is that this was one way in which the Iranians could show the difference from the Arabs. So the Arabs mostly Sunni, the Iranians are Shiites. About 50% plus, if not 55% in Iraq are Shi'is, and 30% in Lebanon. In Syria itself, the Alawites are not Shi'is even. They are an offshoot of Shia Islam. The number of Shi'is in Syria is only about 2%, the Ismailis, the Ismaili minority, and they are focused around, they are concentrating around the city of Homs, which is the center of the rebellion now, but they are quiet. They are peaceful. The rebellion is not among them. And there is also a Shi'i sect in Iran, which is not exactly the same as in Iran, Yemen. Which is not exactly the same as in Iran. They constitute about 30% of the population, the Zaydis. But altogether, the Shi'is are no more than 15-20% of the world of Islam, and the Sunnis are 85-80%.
Diane, thanks for that. A great question. Of course, if we look at the history of Western civilization, there were a lot of wars fought in Europe over questions of religion, whether or not Christ was really in the blood, in the communion wine or not. There were religious wars fought there, not so many recently, however. And so I think perhaps, Professor, maybe I'd like to get your insight into this. One of the problems we have in understanding this conflict is that we are looking at it from an economic, political point of view, rather than this being, it sounds to me, essentially more of a religious dispute in some ways, and maybe even tribal in nature.
Yeah, it's a great question, and yes, you are pinpointing to a very important element of how to understand the modern Middle East, because there are those who would not even like to use the word tribalistic, because it sounds backward and primitive, and it's like portraying the Arabs as if they are, so-called, God forbid, quote-unquote primitive, which of course they are not. But the fact of the matter is you talk here about a sectarian problem between Sunnis and non-Sunnis, Alawites. And the Sunnis do not accept the legitimacy of a regime which is based on people who adhere to an heterodox, not orthodox Muslim doctrine. And, the sectarian element is very strong there. It's not the only problem. There are other issues, but that's the main issue, yeah. And you have it in other parts of the Middle East as well. You have the problem between Shi'is and Sunnis, as I said, also in Lebanon, in a way in Yemen. I mean, 2 years ago, the real conflict in Yemen was not the attempt to overthrow the regime of President Saleh, but the Shi'i rebellion in the northern part of Yemen that not too much was talked about, again, because there was no interest for the American press so much. So, yes, the sectarian problem is very significant in the Middle East, and the question really is, and coming back to your comment about the difference with Christian Europe and all that, is why is it that all those processes of secularization did not take root in the Middle East, in the Islamic Middle East, as they have taken root in Europe? That's a great question. Again, it's beyond the scope of this conversation, but that may give you an answer to the bigger question is, what is the centrality and why is it that Islam is still so central in the politics and society of the Middle East? And therefore, when you are not exactly kosher, so to speak, Islamic or Muslim, you have a problem.
Well, I think that would be a great topic for another program.
Because that's what I'm saying. You know, it's beyond the scope of our particular program.
Right, but it goes to the root of what we have to understand in order to get our arms around this situation. How likely is it that, in your opinion, that we'll see a general civil war in Syria?
Well, in a way, you had a civil war already, you know, and if you refer to the word general as being the difference between the local nature of the conflict now in specific places as opposed to an all-out sectarian civil war, that will happen, if at all, and for a short time, only when the regime finally crumbles. That will take time. Look, the regime is doomed. This is a doomed regime. They can't survive because the majority of their people do not want them. All the ability that the regime had to cow, to frighten, to scare the population, all the means used, failed. The fact of the matter is people are being killed day in, day out, and they still go out and fight back, whether violently through the Free Syrian Army or through civil protests in the streets. So it's just a question of time. When the regime will crumble, then there will be a bloodletting, I'm afraid, and I hope it won't, but there will be bloodletting. There will be revenge taken of the Alawites. There will be a flee of Alawites to the Alawite area of northwestern Syria. That might be the last resort of the regime. The mountains, there might be the so-called Musaddagh, you know, of the Alawite regime. All this will take some time to happen, but it is in the process of being happening. You know, the regime cannot survive it, and I'm afraid that there will be a lot more bloodshed. But I think that many people in the Syrian opposition are aware of the fact that they need to show a different face to the world, and they will try to do their best to contain, to localize, to reduce the levels of violence. For example, the opposition was at pains to make sure that explosions taking place in Damascus a few days ago would not be attributed to them. They deny any complicity with them because innocent civilians were killed, and that's not what the opposition would like to see happening. So all this remains to be seen, but the projection is not so good, I must say. The projection is not so good. You can see the sectarian bloodletting in Iraq these days and what happened there before the surge or after in 2006 and 5 and 6, and that is the shape of things to come in Syria.
We have a caller joining us from Milwaukee who's actually been in Syria recently. Art, good morning and welcome. Give us your insights as someone who's visited the country.
Yeah, we happened to be with former Senator Ebrisk from South Dakota September of last year for more than a week, which was before the outbreak, so I guess we'll call them. And it was a beautiful trip and seemed to be a very stable situation, and we were in Hama, but also in many other places. The expert you have has referred a number of times to minorities, and I missed a little bit of the hour so far, but one of those minorities are the Christians, and I think people in the U.S. maybe in listening to this, you know, the figure was that the Sunnis or the Shia or the Alawites, etc., maybe don't have much of a stake in that battle, but I view it more as a secular government, which, yes, it's obviously dominated by this Alawites, which I think are maybe 10% of the population, with the Sunni majority, but also in a region and in an area where, whatever we'll call it, Muslim fundamentalism is on the rise, I think in part perhaps in response to the heavy U.S. presence in the area in Iraq, etc., and as a backlash. At any rate, this government has tried to resist one segment, I think, dominating another in terms of repressing them. Maybe the Sunnis don't agree necessarily, but they've kept things. So the Christians, for example, which we're given various figures, maybe up to 10% of the population, a lot increase because huge numbers of Christians from Iraq, you know, have had to flee the country with our liberation, made it intolerable for them to even survive. So many of them ended up in Syria and got refuge, and there's many, many Palestinians also receiving refuge in Syria. So I view it as a secular government as opposed to a religious, theocratic, fundamentalist threat, and I think many people in Syria view it that way as well. And I don't know what's going on and since we left, but at that point it seemed to be stable, and I think the Christians and others are very afraid of what might be happening.
Well, first of all, you are absolutely right. There are many Christians, maybe even more than 10%, 10-12%. They are subdivided, by the way, into many churches and groups, so it doesn't create one united Christian population. They also are not constrained in one area, like, say, the Alawites traditionally, or the Druze, or the Kurds, or others. But traditionally, many Christians have been allies of this regime, exactly because they fear the Sunni majority. In that sense, I would agree with our caller 100%. But the rest of it might be somewhat more questionable. Yes, of course, the Syrian regime pretends to be a secular regime when it suits it, and when it doesn't, they use other slogans and they use other ways in order to describe themselves. I think that the fact of the matter is that they are still viewed as a sectarian regime, and this is the main reason why so many of the Sunnis simply do not and will not accept their legitimacy, never mind what they do. But coming back to what can happen in Syria, whether it will be a fundamentalist Islamic regime or not, well, the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood are definitely a very strong and powerful political force that one cannot ignore. But they are not the only one around in the streets right now, and they are just one part of the opposition which is congregated under the auspices of the Syrian National Council. They are one element in it. They are not the only element. And they signed all the declarations of the council which talk about some kind of democracy and try to even appease the fears of the minorities about what is happening. But yes, I will not be surprised if, as part of the bloodletting in Syria, as a result of the final downfall of the regime, there will also be attack on the Christians. I will be surprised if it will not happen. Regretfully, I mean, regretfully, it will happen. Regrettably, and I can remind us all again. We go back to history that in 1860-61, when there was another civil war in the Levant, mainly in Lebanon, but also spread to what is today Syria. Bab Toma, which is the Syrian neighborhood, the Christian neighborhood of Damascus, was attacked and thousands were massacred there. God forbid, no one would like to see it happening. The forces that would like to do it are there, but there are also forces that would prevent it. But altogether, the question was very, very good, and the description was one that I can go along with up to a point.
Art, thanks for the call. So the Arab League monitors are in Syria. What can they accomplish as opposed to what do they hope to accomplish?
Well, you know who is the head of the mission? The head of the mission is a Sudanese general who himself is charged with war atrocities in Darfur in the late 1990s, General al-Dabi. You can read the book about it, the Sorrow, Darfur Sorrow, published by Cambridge University Press, page 262. They describe their the misdeeds of this general. So what can we expect from this general? But look, everybody's playing for time in Syria, the opposition, the regime. Clearly, the situation is beyond control. I mean, nobody can control it really, because even the political leadership of the opposition doesn't necessarily control everything and everybody on the ground. There are all kinds of factions there. The Syrian regime is fighting for its own life, and they're not going to give up. They're not going to give up on their sovereignty up to the point of basically allowing the monitors to do whatever they like in Syria. And I understand now that the monitors themselves are saying that they are not numerically strong enough to cover simultaneously all areas of Syria, so they have to go from one place to another. Look, we are all playing here for time. You can be sure that it is going to go on for quite some time to come. So that will be a good basis for another program. Not that I'm inviting myself, I understand, but there will be more coming from Syria.
Well, I'd be happy to have you back because we've only scratched the surface of this, and
yeah.
I think it's a real shame that this issue has not gotten more attention here in the U.S. We're just about out of time, and I didn't get to this question. Why should the United States look at this as an important part of the world to pay attention to? Why should we be paying more attention to it? What's in it for us?
Well, look, I mean, if what's for you was the humanitarian aspect in Libya, the same applies to Syria. I mean, simple question. Otherwise, it comes back to people saying maybe you and others, it's all about oil, or Libya was weak, so we could intervene. Syria is more strong, so we can't intervene. Where is the morality of all that? It's a good question about where American foreign policy should go. I, by the way, consistently in my writings of this crisis, and I've published a lot on it in the last 9 months, have argued that if I was American policymaker, I would not advocate American military intervention in Syria. For a variety of reasons. But look, the human toll is becoming too much. And if you talk about homes, in this city alone, 300 or 400 people were killed in the last 10 days. You talk about a city the size of Milwaukee, you know, and I know Milwaukee. I mean, with the environment and all that. So imagine if something of this kind happened in Milwaukee in 10 days. God forbid, nobody would like to see that happening.
We would definitely pay attention. And, Professor, I'm sorry, but we're out of time. Joseph Olmert, adjunct professor at American University School of International Service in Washington, D.C. Chrissy Pease produced, and Rhonda Fanning produced this hour. Chrissy Pease handled on air production. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network.